Welcome to a series of netcasts brought to you by Yale University.
Hello, and welcome to another Yale Journal for International Affairs podcast. I'm Alex DeFrond. Today, we'll be talking to Daniel Magaziner, Associate Professor of History at Yale, about the role history plays in post-colonial African politics, how attitudes to the continent in the United States are changing, and the current state of democracy in South Africa, Rwanda, and elsewhere. Stay with us. Professor Magaziner is an intellectual historian specializing in 20th century South Africa. His first book, The Law and the Prophets, Black Consciousness in South Africa, 1968 to 1977, explores the anti-apartheid political thought of student and church activists in 1970s South Africa. He is currently working on two book projects exploring art education in 20th century South Africa and post-colonial architecture, design, and urban planning. Professor Magaziner, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I'm also joined in the studio today by Nelly Mecklenburg, who is a graduate student at the Jackson Institute for Global Affairs.
Hi, Alex. Thanks for having me.
So, Professor Magaziner, we wanted to start with a subject which has been quite prevalent in campus discussion, I think it's fair to say, over the last month or so. In September, Rwandan President Paul Kagame was invited to deliver the prestigious Coca-Cola World Fund lecture at Yale. And some students and faculty criticized the decision to invite President Kagame as an unacceptable legitimization of a leader whom various UN reports have accused of war crimes. At the very least, the organizers were accused of misrepresenting his record by insufficiently drawing attention to his human rights abuses. As president, Kagame has overseen remarkable stability and considerable economic growth since 1994, but he is widely accused of using violence to crush political dissent, curtailing media expression, supporting violent rebel groups in neighbouring countries, and plotting to change presidential term limits in order to keep his position, a change that which was passed in a controversial constitutional referendum last year. In response to his critics, in his speech, Kagame urged the audience to try to understand the specific complexities of Rwanda's history before making judgments. He said, quote, "You must be as humble as you are curious." He also called out the hypocrisy of the United States in criticising his human rights record when they did little during the 1994 genocide. So we begin with two questions. First, how fair do you think Kagame's defence is? How appropriate is it for us to challenge his human rights record? And secondly, what role and responsibilities do you think institutions like Yale have in navigating the politics of inviting such a controversial speaker?
So to your first question, of course he can make that argument. He can make that claim that, you know, the idea of being humble and it is a very problematic argument though, and we need to recognize that it is a problematic argument that goes down a very slippery slope that says that because you failed once, therefore you lose any moral voice down the road. Now, why it's so complicated is because I happen to agree. The United States and the international community, the UN, France, did fail to do anything to stop the suffering of people in Rwanda in 1994. That was an institutional and national failure. And it's a problem that because of that, now there's an alibi that exists that says you didn't do anything then, you didn't care then, so how can you possibly care now? That's just hypocrisy. This was not helped. And this brings us a little bit further afield, in my opinion, by the run-up to the Iraq War, when, again, the United States began to speak this language of intervention, this language of liberal internationalism that the Bush administration used was a very similar language to the language the Kennedy administration used in the 1960s to justify intervention in all sorts of places. Now, we know how that turned out, which, again, adds to this idea that interventionism is wrong. Now, I happen to agree that interventionism is a problem. And I agree that America does not hold moral suasion over African countries. They are not guilty. We are not innocent. That is not how the world works. The problem, though, and I think this gets into your second question, is recognizing all of that and recognizing the complexity of that, having someone like Paul Kagame on campus, in a sense, offers an approval to his perspective on this thing, giving him a forum when he can come and offer a spirited defense of Rwanda and a spirited defense of why we all Americans should sit on our hands and just let him do what they're doing is it's not something that I feel that is in the best interests of the community. We can get into all sorts of arguments about whether or not the U.S. should be, there should be sanctions, whether or not we can get into those arguments. But to me, the issue comes giving someone a form when it's a question is problematic, to put it mildly. And that was why I was very heartened to learn that there were people on campus who were recognizing that this was an inappropriate thing to do. Again, it's complicated. It's complicated in part because it is not a very common occurrence on this campus for an African head of state to come and be feted and be celebrated as someone worthy of respect. That they chose this person, that they invited this man, and I'm not going to speculate as to why this was the person who received the invitation. To me, there was a way that you could have done that in a less problematic way. There's a larger issue, though, at play here, which I think is something that I don't know if we'll talk about, but just I figured I might raise, which is because of the history of interventionism and because of the history of the ways in which this term human rights has been levied as judgment against leaders in the global South and against governments in the global South that are only a generation or two removed from actual colonial rule. You're seeing what is now can be classified as a bit of a retreat from international conventions regarding human rights, most notably in the last couple of weeks when a number of African countries have announced they're leaving the International Criminal Court. And to me, that is a direct – it's the same sort of global geopolitics vis-a-vis questions of human rights and how they are unfairly and unevenly applied that led to Kagame being able to offer such a justification. So I guess to answer your question, I'm kind of trying to parse. I think it's a complicated issue worth unpacking. But to me, it was quite simple that having him at Yale was something that I personally was very uncomfortable with. And I was very glad that I was able to participate in the teach-in opposing it.
And so then how, as a historian, can you, but how can we also, as sort of critics and consumers of culture and politics, employ history? And how can we make sure we avoid faulty analogies? But how do we bring it in where it's appropriate? And where do we know? How do we know where that line is?
So we're in this sort of quadrennial moment of public history in the United States when you bring in all these presidential historians and they say, "Is this election? It's 2016, but is it 1972? No, no, no. It's 1960. No, no, no. It's 1952. And there's this analogizing that goes on. That's not how I think history works. Where I think history works is that history, and again, this is just my opinion and how I practice history. History is the sort of endless or ceaseless probing against accumulated narratives. So when someone says to you, this is the history that matters, you should automatically begin to ask, okay, what is left out of that history? To take the example of Kagame's visit here. When Paul Kagame spoke on campus, there was one history that mattered, and he made this very clear. The history that mattered was the history that began with the advent of the genocide in April 1994. That was where history begins. That's the zero hour. Now, there's a lot more, obviously, that happened before that point, both at the short term, leading up to the onset of the genocide, going back to the early 1990s with the beginning again of the war within Rwanda, and then going back further still to the revolution of the late 1950s, and then back further still to the imposition of Belgian colonialism, and then further still to the construction of the Rwandan kingship. Now, what I think history's job is, and it is not a particular, it's not reducible to sound bites. It's not, in a sense, it doesn't fit on placards very well. But its job is to kind of stand at these moments when people are using the past to claim legitimacy for certain present actions and to kind of trouble that, to trouble the ease with which people do that, to begin to kind of intervene at moments where we can say, look, this is a story. But it's not the only story. So what is to be gained by telling this particular story? History to me, is to be a historian, is to be a critic. And that means, and that's uncomfortable. I mean, the country I studied in South Africa, one of the great issues that's happening now is a lot of historians after the democratic transition in 1994, who had been in an oppositional mode before that point, then pivot and begin to go in an oppositional mode to the current government. And a lot of people within the current government are upset about that because they say, no, history is on our side. But history is not on anyone's side. History is not on the side of – history is on the side of critique. And that, and so I that is what I try to offer as a historian. That's what I try to share with my students. And that is what I think – how history can intervene in the public sphere. The problem is the public sphere is not one that is very – you know, conducive to those sorts of interventions.
Yeah, it seems to me that one of the issues that you seem to be touching on is the way that historians and historical expertise is being used as this kind of political tool by these leaders. And then in a sense that asks the question, like, is it possible for historians to be independent, to be able to use their expertise in a way that facilitates a healthy, nuanced and complex discussion about these issues in a way that doesn't allow them just to be used as a political tool to frame our understanding. And that applies both in places like South Africa and also in places like the United States and how we engage with those countries. How can historians take on that kind of broader role and how can they constructively and productively engage in these conversations?
There's no easy answer to that question. I think that if you want to say, like, what are definitive steps people can take, you can intervene, you can write op-eds, you can do these things. I think one clear thing that I see in South Africa that you see across the continent and you see in the United States as well is the demand to remain independent. Now, there's all sorts of structural limitations on that independence. For example, one of the most striking shifts in historiography on the African continent in the last decade and a half, let's say, has been the rise in Zimbabwe of something known as patriotic historiography, which was a intervention by the Zimbabwean government with a particular agenda vis-a-vis the past, which was to argue that the only sort of history that was going to be produced within Zimbabwe was going to be a history that contributed to the narrative that the Zimbabwean government wanted to tell itself and tell its people about how Zimbabwe had gotten to where it was. Now, what we need to recognize is this then left historians in a very untenable position, because you have a very active history department at the University of Zimbabwe where there were many historians who had kind of cut their teeth as critics, critiquing the white supremacist state in southern Rhodesia and then moving into a critical role as the Mugabe government took power after 1980 in Zimbabwe. But they rely on the Zimbabwean government for jobs. They rely on the Zimbabwean government for the ability to circulate their ideas in journals. So there's these ways in which there are all these structural limits that in Zimbabwe are different than here. We have limits. We have limits regarding tenure. We have limits regarding the demand to publish in certain accepted academic fora. But those limits, those sort of limits that limit how one is able to participate as a historian in Zimbabwe are, of course, not comparable to what we endure here. And what you see then in a place like Zimbabwe is those historians with something critical to say are silenced. And what you see instead is history becomes part of this PR exercise. Now, there are those within the United States, and notably when this patriotic history was first coming to wide renown during the last half decade or so, there was also a lot of debate among historians about this movement to change the history textbooks that were being produced in Texas. And Texas being the largest consumer of history textbooks in the country, therefore determines a great deal of, what the history textbooks get written. And Texas had all these demands about how you talk about slavery, how you talk about, racism, about civil rights, how you talk about the Civil War, all these sorts of things that, in a sense, it was patriotic history by a different name. That there is a history that has to be palatable to our political interests, and that's what history should be. And I think historians, like I said, our job is to kind of combat that in recognition of the fact that some people, because of structural limitations, that's a very, very difficult task.
Mm. I mean, you mentioned previously about the announcement by the Zuma government in South Africa to leave, the intention to leave the ICC. And this comes after, Burundi have already made that step, and there are other countries, the Gambia, for instance, Uganda potentially, who are also making noises in that
Kenya.
Kind of. Kenya, yeah. Absolutely, are making noises in that direction too. And one of the things they say, they claim this kind of identity of victimhood against the West, and they say the ICC is biased. And so to link that to this discussion we're having about the role of historians, I wonder whether, firstly, on the question of, how fair is it that you can say the ICC is biased in this case, in the way that they engage with these countries. And secondly, I'm interested in South Africa specifically. You know, the Mandela government were absolutely pivotal to the establishment of the ICC. Mm-hmm. And I wonder what this shift by the Zuma government says about the political legacy of Nelson Mandela and how his approach to foreign policy is now viewed in contemporary South Africa.
So to the first question, I mean, I think the first question speaks to the larger issues raised by the Kagame visit at Yale, which is this idea that human rights is some sort of universally accepted norm that is applied equally and equitably, that we have to get rid of that concept. Human rights only apply in certain places at certain times, and they tend to be applied as a sort of matter of doctrine and policing where states are weakest. So where you have a weak state, you're going to have the ability of the international community to project power into that state because it has leverage. It has leverage in terms of foreign aid. It has leverage in all sorts of ways. African states have been weaker over the course of the last 50 years than most other states in most parts of the world. They have seen their ability to project and maintain sovereignty within their territorial boundaries undermined because of the nature of the construction of the states during the colonial period, and then the nature of the post-1973 economic crisis that strikes many of these countries. And so what that means is that human rights is continuous with forms of colonial exploitation, as many African peoples experience it. And that's not actually even limited to the post-colonial period, because what you see, the language of human rights emerges during the late 18th into the early 19th century as part of the widespread movement towards abolition of slavery. Now, on the one hand, we think of that as a very good thing, and because it, as it undoubtedly was, in places like Brazil and the United States and, you know, and the Caribbean and so forth. But where it gets complicated was the necessity of abolishing slavery becomes part of the justification for imperialism across the African continent. And Africans know this. People know this. They know the way that human rights was used to justify all sorts of limitations on sovereignty. And so African governments now are in a position where they see who's been prosecuted at the ICC, they recognize that Africans are disproportionately prosecuted because African states have been disproportionately weaker than other states. And there are African heads of state, people like Uhuru Kenyatta, who knows if he loses the upcoming Kenyan election, he might be going to the dock in The Hague. And seeing African governments organizing these ways, on the one hand, it's upsetting. You want to say, oh, you know, the ICC, human rights, et cetera. But the other hand, it actually also is continuous with a politics of sovereignty that has long grappled with the reality of human rights used to contravene that sovereignty. Now, to your specific question in South Africa, Mandela, and I mean, speaking personally as someone who has worked in South Africa and spent the better part of the last 20 years, you know, very closely involved in South Africa, it hurts to see this particular government withdraw from the ICC. It hurts not because I'm a great fan of the ICC, not because I think it's fair, not because I think it's functional, but because I see in that a rejection of an idea that the international community has something to say about what happens within sovereign states. And why that hurts in the South African case is because that was what kept the ANC alive during the years of its exile, was the international community. Both well-meaning liberal folks in the West and the real monetary and military aid provided by the Soviet Union and its allies. Without the international community, the ANC dies. And that now the ANC is saying, we reject this idea of international norms, we reject the idea of this sort of policing, it hurts. Is it surprising? No. I think one of the most striking things that's gone on, and this I wouldn't just limit it to foreign policy, one of the most striking changes in the last half decade or so in South Africa has been a reappraisal of Mandela in general and a reassessment of his legacy. Younger generations of activists within South Africa are much more critical about Nelson Mandela and much more critical about the things that he did and that he stood for. And they are also incredibly critical about Jacob Zuma. Jacob Zuma, if we have to understand his desire his decision to withdraw from the ICC, is part of a larger process of triangulation where Zuma is just trying to figure out where he has a constituency on which he can base his continued presidency in South Africa. So what's happening now, that's part of that process. But in general, what you're seeing with politics in South Africa today is the Mandela era, which is remembered around the world as a sort of a golden age and a culmination of a century worth of civil society movements that had led to the final victory of civil rights against racially delimited laws in South Africa. People don't see it quite so nostalgically on the ground in South Africa today. People are much more critical. And this is just a small, Mandela's foreign policy is just a tiny part of that.
Is that shift connected to a sort of turning against the ANC in general, or view of the ANC as, you know, being corrupt, having sort of failed in a number of the sort of decolonization, anti-apartheid efforts? Which came first, if you can even say that?
It's complicated, because when you say the turn away from the ANC, right, there's a couple ways to interpret that statement. Because on the one hand, you have an electoral turn away from the ANC. In the most recent local government elections for the government of the various municipalities and cities within South Africa, the ANC, as a proportion of the vote, the ANC loses dramatically. They lose control of the major metropolitan areas of Pretoria, of Johannesburg, of Cape Town. But if you look at who's actually governing, say, in Joburg, in Johannesburg, it's a very odd, it's a very odd grouping, because on the one hand you have the economic freedom fighters, and the economic freedom fighters are a breakaway group that break away from the ANC, and that are they are at the forefront of arguing that the ANC is flawed, not just because it's corrupt, not just because Jacob Zuma is a bad guy and potentially a criminal, or most likely a criminal in terms of what he's stolen from the, you know, the government coffers, but also because the ANC has failed as a liberation movement. Because the form of liberation that the ANC under Mandela, under Thabo Mbeki, put forward in the 1990s into the early 2000s was one that preserved the status quo, which meant white minority capital still running pretty much everything, and blacks still not having land. And that is a major force in South African politics. The EFF is a very effective third party. What they've actually been able to do is now govern with the Democratic Alliance. Now, the Democratic Alliance is a very odd bedfellow for the EFF, because the Democratic Alliance was a party that in many ways, since 1994, its name has changed, it's shifted, but it became the home for many of the white voters who had previously supported the National Party under apartheid. It's not the National Party. It's not a white supremacist party. Its leadership is black now, and that's a, you know, strategic political move on their part. But it is a party of liberalism, which means something very different in South Africa than it does in the United States, where liberal and progressive are sometimes used as comparable terms. It's a conservative party. It's about the status quo. It's about, I should say, the economic status quo. It's all about good government and therefore critiquing the ANC as somehow criminal and corrupt. But it is not about radical redistribution, and it actually has no problems with how the transition took place. So the fact that they are now governing together with the EFF in places like Johannesburg, what that signifies is not that they have reached some sort of, there's a common cause of opposition in South Africa. It signifies that what people agree on is they don't like the ANC, and that the ANC now is faced with a group, a constituency within South Africa. To put it in different terms, there's an interesting spatialization of politics going on. The ANC's control over rural areas, over the poorest people, is still intact. And South Africa is a really poor country, so that's a lot of people covered in that tent. But in the cities, with upwardly mobile people, with people with some degree of education, the ANC is losing that constituency, which means they're actually losing a great deal of the sorts of people who were ANC members going back to the first real broad-based struggles of the 1950s. And there's this interesting way in which civil society is moving against the ANC, which is surprising, given where the ANC had begun and where it had built its strength during the 1950s and the period thereafter.
Yeah, just to expand a little bit more on the significance of those municipal election results, I think one other shift it implies is people no longer just continuously voting for the Party of Liberation, regardless of how corrupt and inefficient they may be, and whether that's a trend we might see in other African countries. And another potential shift is the shift away from people purely voting by racial bloc and actually maybe voting in other ways. Like you mentioned, for instance, you know, income inequality and geography and things like that. So are you optimistic about these shifts? And do you think they could spread beyond South Africa?
Optimism. One of the things that's quite striking, and I see the fact that the EFF, and I have the Julius Malema, the leader of the EFF, is not someone that he's not like a pure figure in politics. He's a deeply flawed individual, although there are things about him I think that are tremendously admirable. But one of the things that it suggests with these new governments of EFF and DA collaboration is that the left is the real loser in South African politics, because the EFF has moved into the embrace of the DA, and the DA has different interests. The DA's constituency is different than that of the EFF's, but the EFF is a small party numerically, and this gives them the power to be kingmakers. So they move into those governments. But what this suggests is that there is no real viable left alternative in South Africa anymore. And so optimistic, am I optimistic? I mean, I'm not invested in whether or not people stop supporting the ANC and whether or not people stop to vote as racial blocs. I think race is a reality in South Africa, and I think there's a lot of legitimate reasons why people would vote as a racial bloc. I think especially for black South Africans, there is a great deal of mistrust of white South Africans, and there ought to be, because that's what history reveals. The ANC was not, I mean, I think what's happening now is people are not voting for a liberation movement. I think they are not voting for a party that is not acting in their interests as they see it. It's not that they have kind of moved past this idea that the liberation movement, you know, deserves their vote. I think that they just feel that their interests are now more varied. Without a viable left, though, it's hard to see how South Africa, I mean, we can be optimistic about the rise of, you know, potentially competitive presidential elections and so forth. But one of the striking things is that for the vast majority of South Africans, life has not gotten appreciably better since 1994. And I don't think that absent an actual left critique, you're going to actually have that be part of the agenda. Instead, you're going to have different technocratic elements of the ANC and the DA angling for party leadership. And that's fine, you know, but it's not, they maybe government will get better, but you're not going to actually get into some real questions that the Mandela government did not ask about how to actually dramatically transform people's lives. And so I'm not optimistic, because I don't think that South Africa is on the cusp of dramatically transforming people's lives. I wish that it was, but I don't think it has been for 26 years. I don't know why that would change now.
Yeah, I mean, to perhaps challenge your uncertainty about being optimistic, it seems like the anger with the ANC is being expressed in two ways at the moment. So one would be in the ballot box, and the other seems to be this trend, this rise in violent protest happening on student campuses and elsewhere. And it seems perhaps this anger with the ruling party could go either of those two ways. They could go down a democratic route, being expressed in the ballot box or on the streets. Do you have a sense about how those two things interact and whether one approach might win out over the other?
Well, it's notable because on the one hand, you can see a lot of student protests as almost a proxy struggle, because you have different student groups that are the sort of university iterations of larger political entities. And that during the Fees Must Fall protest, it was striking to see what happened when the ANC-aligned student groups, this is now last fall, our fall, yeah, in 2015, when they got involved in protests, suddenly we were talking about something that was reaching up into the Thule House, which is where the ANC headquarters is in Joburg. And there was this way in which the ANC was needing to respond. But then you saw that ANC loyalists within the student ranks kind of then diffused some of these protests. What you're seeing now is a form of protest that's emerged since about January, February 2016, which doesn't map directly onto electoral politics in some way. It's notable that some of the most radical and organized elements within student groups are in some way affiliated with the EFF, but the EFF as an organization is pursuing now a very different political path than those students are advocating for. Again, this is just my opinion, but I am not, I was quite taken by the Fees Must Fall movement last fall. I was quite taken by the potential for university students doing what they had done in the past in South Africa and elsewhere, and changing the conversation and forcing the government to reckon with some things that had not taken place. I think that things have gone off the rails. I think that now the effort is to simply disrupt the workings of the government in its local manifestation, which is the workings of universities. And I think that what's happened in many of these South African universities have had to cancel their academic years, beginning, you know, within the last few weeks. Exams aren't being written. People are falling behind. And such a small percentage of the South African population has access to tertiary education in the first place. The numbers are really, really very small. They happen to be in places that occupy a great deal of the media spotlight. So it seems like it's a much bigger civil society revolution. But it's not. It's university students. And it's now what you have is you have a small number of university students who are seeing the politics of disruption as following to their own natural end. Disrupt for the sake of disrupting. Now, under the struggle in the 1980s, the struggle to end apartheid, so too did students think that, and it was very effective, and I historically made a great deal of sense. Now what you're seeing, though, is that there are many students who are poor, who sacrifice a great deal to get a tertiary education, and now they're not being able to go to class and write their exams. And the future for Black South Africans, unemployment rates are skyrocketing. The South African economy is really hurting. And has been since, you know, especially the last couple of years as Jacob Zuma has played around with his finance ministries. You're beginning to see there's just the possibility of real progress. I just don't know where it comes from. And this is where I'm left from a position of where I actually think that my lack of optimism is somehow, I don't want to say it's good, but it might be correct. Okay. Let's just call it a realism. Because I don't know what happens next. Because if you look at it, people are demanding that the government provide totally free education. There are plenty of people in South Africa who should not get a free education. They can afford to pay for education. So that across the board isn't going to work. Then you're going to say, okay, what's going to happen if you cut off if you say that education must be free? What you're really talking about is then the government is going to have to give more money to these universities so that the universities can offer a totally free education if they want it to maintain what South Africa now has, which are competitive universities with well-paid and well-educated staff who do a really good job training tremendous numbers of young South Africans and offering them positions in the future. The problem then is if you're not going to totally radically change South Africa's tax laws and you're not going to work in some ways to nationalize and to be able to consolidate resources, that money is going to come from somewhere else. South Africa has tremendous social problems, including a population that isn't employed as much as it was before. So you're taking money out of some people's pockets and putting them in the universities through the sort of some people's pockets, meaning South Africans who receive welfare payments. So basically, absent a total reassessment and recreation of the tax code and a thinking creatively about redistribution of resources, to demand a totally free education and say that absent that, we're going to burn this place down, which is what you've seen in some quarters, is to lead down a slippery slope where someone else, that money is coming from somewhere, that South African government has a limited ability to provide resources across the board. I don't know. It just seems like a very dangerous place to be in.
The Fees Must Fall protests that were happening last year, which were, you know, on one level about tuition hikes, which you're talking about, they were also about sort of, as you were talking about, sort of how far the Liberation mm-hmm. Party and movement didn't go, about the lingering inequality, increasing inequality, about structural change generally across the university system and beyond, across the government, that never came to fruition. And similarly, you know, when that was happening, there was also, you know, explosive protests in the U.S. Mm-hmm. Different scale in terms of violence, absolutely, but it was also about sort of deeper structural issues and change that hadn't mm-hmm. happened. Were these protests sort of part of the same moment? I mean, was there a link going on? Was there a dialogue between these things? is there something happening in the U.S. and South Africa and other African countries where there's other student protests happening? Is this part of a moment like the 60s were?
That would be no. Let's just say I don't see evidence for that. I think what you saw in the particular case of and you'll forgive me, I don't see there a widespread student movement in the United States right now. There were protests last year, and they were vital protests that intervened at critical moments about issues of race and representation and fairness on campus. But I don't think campuses are in flames right now. I don't see there's not, and I don't mean literal flames, but I mean like inflamed with politics. Having been on campus here last year and this year, there is a very marked difference in the way things are being talked about on campus, how change has been institutionalized in a way that was a predictable outcome of the student protests last year, but it is nonetheless a departure from that. Where there were some overlaps, I think most explicitly were in the days or the months before Fees Must Fall really took off in South Africa. And there's a couple things that need to be noted. First, Fees Must Fall as a social movement on campuses actually started well before anyone knew about #... must fall language. There had been poor students on what had been under apartheid known as the Bush colleges, which were the kind of colleges that the apartheid government had created for the training of Africans to serve the government's purposes in the creation of these nub states known as Bantustans over the course of the 60s and 70s in particular. And these colleges were chronically underfunded. They were deeply problematic places. And black students after apartheid, those schools are 99 to 100% African. And they still exist, and they're 99 to 100% African. And they get a lot less money than do the flagship universities where Africans have just only moved into the majority, places like the University of Cape Town, Rhodes University, and so forth. So Fees Must Fall began in those universities. What garnered the first real international attention was the Rhodes Must Fall movement, which begins in March 2015, and where the language of #MustFall is introduced. And Fees Must Fall then kind of picks that up and brings it to those concerns that had already been expressed. There's a lot to be said about the connection between Rhodes Must Fall and political organizing on this campus last year, which was based on both cases, a sense that having been, despite transformations, despite efforts to create a more equitable environment on campus, the legacy of racial segregation, the legacy of racial hierarchies remain intact. You see it here in arguments about Calhoun, and very clearly on campus at UCT, the University of Cape Town, you see it with this argument about Rhodes and about this idea that this man who's has this statue on campus, who is the prime benefactor of the university, on whose property the university sits, but who also had been the person who benefited most from the exploitation of African labor during the industrial period that creates South Africa as a major player in the international economy. It's kind of inappropriate that he's still sitting there. And that sort of symbolic protest and the language of it being a place where people can feel like they have a home, a place where their bodies are comfortable, that is the same language that you saw very much expressed on campus here. And I think it was to call it an international moment, I'm a little skeptical of categorizing that way. I think one of the things that's really interesting is that Yale has a long institutional relationship with UCT. We send a lot of people to UCT to study abroad. And my students who went to UCT, I think, found a lot of common language being deployed at UCT. But I think it was primarily one way. I don't think that many South African students with their concerns and their issues spend a lot of time thinking about Yale or thinking about University of Missouri or a place like that, another place that very much was inflamed by these politics of race and equity last year. And I don't know that I would hesitate to classify it as that we are living in another moment kind of like the 1960s where it seems like the international category student is one of being politically active and engaged.
Before we finish, we want to talk briefly about attitudes towards Africa, this imagined monolith, a little more broadly. You're on the editorial board of a blog called Africa as a Country, whose title plays with this image that we have in the West and elsewhere, that, you know, the African continent is is one unit and we can sort of talk about it as one entity. Mm-hmm. But since you've been in the field for 20-some years, as you were just saying, how has the idea of Africa changed in the public imagination? And on that, sort of, what fantasies or assumptions have disappeared and what new ones have replaced them?
Well, it's interesting because there's a couple ways to answer that question. So Africa as a country is, again, as you said, the name is ironic. It's not the Africa of the imagination. It's actually the Africa of public media discourse. And it was founded by my colleague, Sean Jacobs, in the late, I don't know what you call it, last decade, the aughts, let's call it, in the late aughts, as a space to intervene against public perceptions that Africa was one place and that all Africans are certain, act in certain ways. And it's expanded from that. And one of the things that's notable about its expansion is we no longer spend a lot of time every time someone makes some gross generalization about Africa engaging with that. We no longer say, like, you know, there would have been a time, say, when you have someone like Taylor Swift's Wildest Dreams video, mm-hmm. which comes out and it traffics in all these sort of colonial nostalgia stereotypes, and it offers this idea of Africa as this place with the lions and the, you know, the breezes of the Serengeti and whatnot, where we would have been like all in to kind of engage with that. And we don't do that. And we don't do that in part because we think that battle by conscious people has been won. People who, because of the internet, because of social media, people have access to more and more information. I shouldn't have said has been won. Let's just say there's other battles to be fought. There are certain things that are never, you're just gonna have to constantly combat. For example, one of the most common perceptions of Africa in recent days has been this idea, this slogan that I believe was coined by The Economist, I don't know for certain, was Africa Rising. And this idea that across the early 2000s, you saw economic indicators going up in many African countries, you saw democracy going up in many African countries, you saw participation in politics increasing, you just saw things on the rise. Now, what that meant was suddenly people said, oh, look, Africa's good now. And so a lot of the issues that continue to dog the continent in terms of treatment of women, in terms of treatment of what are euphemistically known as sexual minorities in many parts of the continent, in terms of just general kleptocracy, people then kind of changed their perspective and looked away from those and instead just focused on good indicators as they saw it. Then, of course, now, recently, people have said, oh, okay, Africa's not rising. And there was, for example, Jeffrey Gettleman, who's very good for these sorts of generalizations, had a long piece in the Times a couple weeks ago where he basically said Africa isn't rising. And he's generalized and said, if you look across Africa, you see a continent in flames. You see protests. You see repression. You see this and the other thing. Now, of course, the fact of the matter is Africa as a whole was never rising nor falling. Some African countries were doing well. Some were not. Some African countries now are not doing as well. Some are. It's a picking and choosing depending on the narrative of the moment. And that was really, I think, what Africa Country tries to combat. And we combat that in a lot of different ways, one of which is by offering, going back to our earlier conversation, these critical interventions where we say, okay, that and, or not that, and something else. Like, we just try to offer different voices. And so one of the ways that we do this is by pointing out how conventional thinking gathers around certain issues. For example, one of the pieces that I liked best was one that was done by one of our colleagues maybe a year ago or so, which looked and say, okay, if you look at books published on Africa, many of them have the exact same image on the cover, the sunset, the tree, Africa. And trying to show that actually there's also this implied rural-urban dichotomy that's created there, and to show instead what's happening in these dynamic cities, what's happening with culture, who are the cultural producers, what is the fashion scene like? And this is something that is, I think, not we do this work, but there are other websites that do this work, and it's something that's also being picked up elsewhere. This year, African contemporary artists broke all the records at various contemporary art fairs. You can say what you will about the contemporary art market. It's also a little short in history. They don't recognize that Africans were producing what would be classified as contemporary art for decades, but now it's found an audience. So there are ways in which the rest of the world is kind of catching up to our insistence, what we've had and what others before us have argued, that these are places of enormous complexity and they defy generalization, as does everywhere. And this is, Africa tended to be a place that was very easy for people to kind of lapse into these stereotypes and generalizations, going back for hundreds of years. And so what we're trying to do is say at some point, we have to understand complexity and we have to allow a space for complexity to be manifest.
Right. And then like a final question, I wonder whether we could then flip Nelly's question on its head and ask what the image that Africans themselves are creating for themselves. And I know some of your current research explores the history of architecture and design and urban planning and perhaps the creation of maybe a post-colonial identity. Mm. And I wonder whether that links to your answer. But yeah, what do you think is that new identity that Africans themselves would like to create?
Well, I can't answer that question. Because it is not my responsibility to talk about what the new identity people want to create. But I can take the historian's cop-out and answer that those who I've studied, and one of the things that I'm very excited about, and I thank you for the question, is in this new project that I've just recently embarked on, which builds on the work that has been done by historians of architecture and others who've studied this for decades, is that one thing we don't recognized was how central African institutions and African thinkers were in the creation of what this kind of contentious term modernity and the middle part of the 20th century. And so among the people I'm studying is a guy named Selby Mvusi, who was a South African painter who became an art teacher, who became a sculptor, who became a theorist, who became an industrial designer, who became a sort of radical architectural pedagogue at the University of Nairobi in the mid-1960s. And Nairobi at this time was this incredibly dynamic place where he was working past all sorts of theories, seen at places like MIT, at Harvard, in Europe, and in Ulm and other sites, about how to approach issues of the built environment in the 1960s. And getting past the common developmental approach, getting into notions that were really thinking about how people, as he understood it, how people spatialize their identities through the construction of new physical forms. And he was reading all of the theorists and he was critiquing them and saying, no, this doesn't apply. And in fact, what we want to do in Nairobi is push past your description or your limiting of how Africa is supposed to be to push towards new ways of being in the 20th century. And he was a utopianist who thought that from Nairobi could develop new ways to be a human being in the middle of the 20th century, which is what a lot of the 1960s was about. Here was someone who was thinking through existential crises with so many of the great thinkers and theorists that we think about in the 1960s. My argument is it shouldn't really matter that he was African. It only matters that he's African because we think that Africans weren't doing such things. But he was, as were so many others, and trying to recover the fact that one thing we have to unlearn in our study and our approaches to Africa is unlearn our expectations of what African history was, what went on there, who the actors were and what they were thinking about and what they were concerned with. Because if we do that, then we can begin to institutionalize that complexity at an earlier stage and then hopefully carry it forward so that we don't always have to combat this idea that Africa is and has always been this one way. And that's how it's going to remain.
What a note to finish on. Sadly, that's all we have time for. Thank you very much to Daniel Magaziner for joining us. Thanks also to Jack Lawrence for our theme music and to Phil Kearney for producing this podcast. In the coming weeks, we'll be talking to Mark Oppenheimer about the future of journalism and to Emma Skye about her career as a political advisor to the US military in Iraq. Keep informed of those by subscribing to this podcast on iTunes. Visit our website at yalejournal.org and follow YJIA on Twitter and Facebook. Thank you for listening. Until next time, goodbye.